You're listening to Psych Talk.
On this hour, you're listening to Psych Talk, and I'm your host, Jose Dras Lopez. Today, our guest is Dr. Pate Skeen. He's a longtime neurobiologist at Duke University, studying axon growth in developing brains. He's also studying the genes and neural mechanisms underlying cooperation and punishment. This work in social cognition could have important applications in criminal, civil, and environmental law. In addition to his career in science, Dr. Skeen is in the middle of getting a law degree, also at Duke. We'll try to bring all his talents in our topic, which is neuroscience and the law. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So I was asking as a preface before we got on air whether you plan on practicing law. I'm going to ask you again because it just seems you've had this long career studying axon growth. You already have your legacy there and you could turn around and become a student again. What motivated that?
Well, I think several things. Law has always been fascinating to me, but in recent years, both neurobiology and evolutionary biology have made a lot of progress in understanding how people act in social groups, how we think about decisions about interacting with others, and how those decisions sort of play out to make us be able to live in large, stable, organized societies in which we behave reasonably decently toward each other and try to contain those of us who are inclined not to. I found that really interesting from a basic point of view. And as I began looking more into it and talking to colleagues in law schools and other areas, became really fascinated with the practical side of that, which is what law addresses. How do we do that in practice?
Right. And you're well through getting your law degree. So I'm curious, with some hindsight, what sort of questions can you ask now that you wouldn't have been able to ask before trying out the law degree?
It's a great question. And the first thing I discovered as I started as a 1L, first-year law student, is that I'm not the first person who's thought about these questions. Lawyers, legal scholars, have been thinking about this for hundreds of years and have had quite a few insights about how people interact, and particularly about the business of a society as a whole coming together and making some rules for those people who sometimes don't do what the group would prefer. So it was really fascinating to find out the insights that people have had over the years and then just try to map that onto what we're beginning to learn about how the brain carries out those activities. So that's true in whether we're talking about how we think about punishing in criminal law, what's that about? Why do we do that? What does that serve for society? Whether we're talking about civil law, tort law, or contracts, and how we want people to interact with each other, or whether we're talking about rules like the government regulating, whether that's environmental regulation or banking or other things. So I don't think I would have seen quite the scope of that without getting that exposure that all of us get in the first year of law school.
Yeah. Basically, it sounds to me like you're saying that neuroscience is not treading completely new revolutionary ground. It's adding an extra layer of subtlety to ideas that are very old, that come from philosophy or from legal scholarship. If we're adding this extra layer, what sort of tools does neuroscience give us to have a more nuanced understanding of what's happening in the brain? Where's neuroscience going to give us the most leverage?
Certainly doing brain imaging scanning is one really powerful tool because it begins to let us ask people to carry out tasks in the scanner that they would carry out in reduced versions of what they would carry out in everyday life, and then see what parts of the brain are contributing to that. And that's one tool. We can look at how various animals do comparable things. I'm involved in studies with macaque monkeys who are free-ranging in various contexts and therefore have their own social groups and engage in their own social lives. And we can at least observe, you know, what they are doing. And how a non-human primate solves some of these same problems or doesn't, and take that sort of evolutionary perspective. And we can look at genetics. We can look at if we have developed brains that help us live in these large social groups, we can kind of look at the traces in our genes of how we evolve those traits to become the kind of people we are and maybe understand the underpinnings a bit. And for taking your perspective of this as a layer on that, I think what basic science often does is ask, we're seeing a phenomenon in life, in this case, social organization and social justice, and now how do our brains do that? What's the mechanism? And I think that's basically what we're trying to do.
Right. Well, we're going to keep bouncing between the basic science and the applications. And for a moment, I want to look at one application of sort of merging neuroscience with the law, which is trying to figure out why wrongful convictions happen, why people falsely end up in jail, and DNA evidence later shows that they really were innocent. So what can neuroscience tell us or do to help us prevent in the future wrongful convictions and still rightfully convict the guilty people?
Yes, I think that's a fantastic example of what neurobiology and neuroscience generally might be able to offer. Because if you think about the problem that a police investigator or a prosecutor faces, this is when something bad has happened, a crime has happened, something has gone wrong. You want to know who did it, or you want to know whether what somebody did should be adjudged wrong. There's a complex set of decisions that have to be made, choices that have to be made, and we would describe that in neuroscience as decision-making under uncertainty. There is almost no way you can have some, it's rare that you would have really definitive evidence one way or the other about who did it. So the initially the police investigators and then the prosecutors who are deciding whom to prosecute and when to bring a case, I have a really tough choice of deciding when do I have the right person and can proceed with the case. And I think we both have theory and studies of people and animals making those kinds of decisions, coming to decisions, often simple decisions, gambling tasks or laboratory tasks. But we can begin to understand how they use an anticipation of a reward, a juice award or money or something of that kind, to make a decision. We can break down the decision-making process. Then we can go to these more complex decisions and say, what if what you were driven by is a great internal sense, a sense in your own self, your own brain, that I want to do justice. Something bad has happened, and it's important that we find the person and do justice. And if that's your reward, what kind of decisions will you make? What's the process? And then if we can identify the places where a person driven by justice would be most prone to overweight or underweight evidence, I think we can begin to think about how to develop better procedures that will increase the accuracy and decrease the inevitable error rate.
Right. And we do have some preliminary ideas of what unduly influences a jury. For example, they're one of the decision maker stakeholders in justice. I know that eyewitnesses are given a lot of weight, and about 3/4 of the wrongful convictions that have been found with DNA exonerations were due to or closely involved with eyewitness testimony, very confident saying that's the person who did it. So that seems to be one area to keep looking into. Why do people trust eyewitnesses, or why do eyewitnesses have confidence when they shouldn't?
Yes. Another really important area and one where basic science, neuroscience in general, I think has made some insights. I would say that when I was growing up, many of us probably have a sort of intuitive sense that an eyewitness is about the best evidence you can have. I saw him do it. They did it. I saw them. That was the person who did it, and I saw them do something that was wrong. What they did was a crime. We actually now know that that's really terrible evidence. It's one of the worst kinds of evidence you can have, and it's not because people are stupid or people are bad. It's because crimes, events happen in daily life. They happen quickly. They happen under non-ideal circumstances. If it's a crime like a bank robbery or a murder or some violent crime, it's scary. We're not at our best recording information. In addition, we know that memories, perceptions, what we believe, we can probably all think about examples in our daily life where you kind of mix up things. Something happens, and then later something else happens, and you see somebody, and then you see them again, and you see them again, and you start remembering, now, was that the person who was at that party who was, you know, doing the silly dance, or was that somebody else? But in the case of eyewitness identification, things can happen in the course of an investigation where completely unintentionally, it could happen intentionally, but we hope it most of the time unintentionally, the police investigator may kind of give clues to the witness. They don't mean to, just by their facial expression or their reaction. Yeah, that's the person we think did it. Or it might be even more innocent, that the person, the witness, saw somebody, the accused person, didn't realize they had seen it, but began to think that was the person, and in their own mind, mistakenly, put them into the memory. So we now know a lot about how those kinds of mistakes can happen, and I think courts are beginning to recognize that they need to take into account the kinds of errors that eyewitnesses are prone to.
Right, and a lot of these issues, I just recently read some of your colleagues wrote up a sort of a summary of different findings related to eyewitnesses. I don't remember all their names, so maybe you can mention some of the collaborators at Duke that you've been starting to speak with. They were looking at different factors that could make eyewitnesses too confident. And they were mentioning, for example, just asking someone repeatedly about who did it. The more times you ask someone, the more they sort of get rigid and think, yes, this is definitely the person who did it, which is a pretty innocuous thing to just ask more times. And they were mentioning that the same sorts of problems with giving positive feedback make someone think, oh, I definitely made the right choice, rather than questioning, did I fill in a memory from an array of pictures I looked at?
Yes, a number of groups around the country have been studying that. Famously, Beth Loftus has done a lot of work in that area and has been a real pioneer for quite a few years. And several of us at Duke, several people at Duke, some of whom I'm involved with and some of whom are colleagues who are doing their own work, are interested in this kind of thing. At the law school, we have a small and growing group of people who are interested in developing some of these approaches, both in the eyewitness level and in the decision-making and other processes, other stages. The Wrongful Convictions Clinic and a group that's working on professional responsibility and criminal justice, headed by Jim Coleman and Teresa Newman at the law school, and Neil Vidmar, a psychologist who's actually a professor in the law school and was wonderful in encouraging me to get involved as well, sort of convincing me that old PhDs can learn something about the law. That group has now developed a research program in which they're sort of systematically looking at the causes of wrongful convictions, and we're increasingly recruiting and discovering more colleagues at Duke who are doing the kinds of research that you were describing.
Right. Once we look at the decisions that everyone's making together, we can frame it in terms of neuroscience by talking about neuroeconomics. Tell us what that is and why it's a little different from economics, or why it's not just good old common sense.
Well, we like to think that it will either merge with common sense or maybe occasionally identify situations in which the common intuition may be mistaken. Neuroeconomics is a phrase that grew out of sort of the merger of decision-making sciences in the neuroscience tradition and a tradition in economics, behavioral economics, in which economists were moving over a long period of time from the older model, we would say the rational self-interested actor. That is, models in which you assume that people made decisions, economic decisions, market decisions, choices in what they buy or what they do with their finances, based on rational models. They have complete information and they just do what would be the rational thing to do. As you know, we're discovering more and more these days that's not really how we make decisions. And that understanding came in part from a tradition in economics in which economists began looking at actual behaviors of people in markets, of people making financial decisions, of people making other kinds of choices. So the economists began to develop behavioral economics. Psychologists joined in that, and famously long series of studies looking at forms of irrationality. I actually don't like that term because I think a lot of those heuristics and biases, that is mental shortcuts and the various kinds of biases that people have, are actually quite sensible things to do in many circumstances when you need to make a decision quickly and you don't have complete information. So I hate to call it irrational, but at least they are departures from what you might think of as a rational model. And in the meantime, certainly by about 10 years ago, people in neuroscience were beginning to take on these questions about how people and animals make choices and realizing that the behavioral economists had a lot to teach us and maybe we had something to offer them in terms of the brain mechanisms underlying that. And as those fields came closer together, somebody came up with the idea of calling that neuroeconomics.
Right, right. Well, you mentioned animals, and it reminds me of this idea that even though it's always helpful to focus on what we're doing wrong, the mistakes we're making, the wrongful convictions we're making, we are doing some things right. And especially put in historical perspective, I'm reminded of Steven Pinker's recent book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, talking about how violence has declined across the centuries, partly because our organized government, our legal system has gotten more refined, and we've sort of been able to trust some third party to punish for us instead of forming our own vendettas. And there's something that you probably don't see in macaques or third-party punishment. But what do you think about this difference between animals and humans and what it tells us about what we're doing sort of right
I think we're doing a lot of things right. And I think that when we talk about things like wrongful convictions or error rates or irrationalities, I think it's really important for all of us to remember, including those of us who are doing this kind of research, that while we tend to focus on the error rate, but what we're really talking about is the accuracy rate, these heuristics and biases, these things that we do that sometimes lead us to make errors, are there. We evolved them, and they serve it because they serve us pretty well. When you need to make a decision quickly, some sort of rule of thumb, some sort of mental process that lets you sort of have a gut feeling, this is the right thing to do, and I can make a decision in a second when I need to swerve out of the way, I need to respond to something. If that works 80 or 90% of the time, that's a spectacularly effective process. The fact that it has a certain error rate that we can study is more like, of course, we want, in the case of something like wrongful convictions or other bad outcomes, we want to decrease the error rate, improve the accuracy. But another way of looking at that is simply we look at the occasional times, whether that's 10 or 20% of the time, when it doesn't have the outcome we desire, simply as a tool to figure out how does the process work. And I think that's really important, especially if we think about something like wrongful convictions, that we not get in mind that we are somehow, as academics, saying prosecutors do a bad job. I think the correct conviction rate, we need to study, but I suspect it's very high. And that those heuristics, the experience, the kinds of decisions that people are making there are really pretty good. We'd like to see if we can make them better, but you correctly point out, we make pretty good decisions a lot of the time.
Right. I guess it depends what standard we set as ideal, because we can imagine some kind of godly philosopher who has all the time in the world to sort of stretch out a second of information and analyze it every possible way. And we use that as our standard of rationality based on like very academic logician style thinking. Then we can say, oh yeah, there's a lot we could be doing that we're not. But when we think we're organisms, we're animals with brains and limited time and different strains on our attention, that's when we see that we're not doing so bad with all our constraints.
Absolutely. And other sort of intuitive senses that we have. Most of us behave reasonably decently toward each other an awful lot of the time. We behave fairly a lot of the time. One area that I'm particularly interested in, a sense of fairness or a sense of what's the right thing to do, and that we don't like it very much when we see people not doing that, that's a pretty good, effective way to run a society or to have a society work. If most of us have kind of a sense of what's fair and what's okay to do and what's really not right, and some of us are willing to, if we see something done wrong, maybe step up and say, you really shouldn't do that, or maybe just we don't like hanging out with those people so much. That's not a bad way to keep our society running reasonably decently most of the time, and it cuts down on the need for things like active punishment.
Right. So back to neuroeconomics. I wonder if neuroeconomics is essentially social psychology with some kind of neuroscience measurement thrown in, because you're looking at people making decisions in experimental contexts or in social contexts, and in the basic setup of any sort of experiment or observation is just what social psychologists are interested in, right? So where does the neuro part come from?
Quite a number of years ago now, one of my friends and colleagues who was an early advocate of this kind of work gave a talk, and at the introduction he was talking about some behavioral economics, and he said, I understand what we get from them, but what do they get from us? Asking the question of what we as neuroscientists had to offer to the behavioral economists and the social psychologists who are doing this sort of work. And I think perhaps 10 years ago, the answer might be, well, not too much, maybe some interest in mechanism. I think it's grown now that as we're beginning to understand some of the brain circuits and some of the brain mechanisms that contribute to these decisions, you can start thinking about what are the implications of that for behavior. What would you predict, or how would you predict that these particular mechanisms might alter the way a person makes certain kinds of decisions? So now we're beginning to get that information feeding back to the social psychologists and to the behavioral economists so to change the experiment, to say, well, do people really behave that way? Does that really explain anything new or change our understanding? So it's beginning to be more of a two-way street now.
Right. Well, one thing that strikes me about adding the neuro to neuroeconomics, the neuroscience to our understanding of people's behavior, is that it just feels much more biological. It changes our intuitions in some sense, maybe more than it should rationally, but just the sense that all of a sudden, oh, it's the person's brain, not their mind, that's behaving, can change our sense of culpability, or it can make our fallibilities make more sense. For example, the study in Israel where judges who were hungry right before lunch were much less likely to grant parole. The parole granting rate was like down near 0%, like 10%, whereas when they had just eaten, they were granting parole to most people. If you just think of these judges as rational minds, that's inconceivable. But if you think of them as sort of low on glucose, then exactly. Irritable, it's biological humans, then that just that intuition shifts.
I think that's a really great point and a great example. When you think about this as a biological process, it's just the mechanism by which we do what we do. It doesn't change anything. It may change for some people, but in general, these philosophers, political scientists, economists have for generations realized we are biological creatures. And so it's not that it fundamentally changes things. But once we begin to think about the particular mechanisms, you might think to do a study like the one in Israel, which is a fascinating study. And when you look at those patterns, if you imagine the judges themselves, you are a judge who's doing that, and you see that pattern, now you can step back rationally and say, oh, I didn't realize I did that. I will take that into account. I will sort of observe myself. And I think we can apply that understanding, help us understand ourselves, maybe even forgive ourselves. The fact that I do that, if I were one of those judges, the fact that I do that, it's not a personal failing. It's a biological fact that I can now take into account.
Right. Bring some snacks and try to counterbalance
exactly.
The effect. Okay. Well, this question of shifting our intuitions by looking at people as more biological raises these broader questions about free will and how we blame people and whether we're just trying to, as a part of our legal system, to get back at them sort of retributively, like show them what they deserve, or if we're just trying to prevent harm and restore them. One question is, can the law accommodate the sense that everyone's behavior is determined by biological factors? Can the law take that fact and still assign blame?
Yes, I think people it's an area in which people disagree and have had a lot of discussion. I think the debate or the discussion, at least among the philosophers, as I understand it, is actually moving in a very positive direction. Some of which is, you know, this isn't that different from what we've thought all along. We need to come to terms with thinking about it as a brain processing. But did we really? At what point did we not think this was a manifestation of something going on in the brain? So in some ways, philosophers, lawyers, people thinking about this problem have stepped back a little and said, well, this gives us insight. But if you thought in retributive terms, does this really make that go away? You mentioned biologically deterministic, and in some sense you would say that's true. That is, biological processes, the firing of neurons in our brain and so forth, are the mechanism by which we do things, but deterministic in the sense of predetermined, I think, is not supported by the biology, really one way or the other. We don't know. It doesn't really change what that the outcome is predictable at some point in advance and cannot be disrupted or altered by any conscious processes. I think we know that that's not true. In fact, we were just discussing with the judges the fact that you know that something
right.
is biologically driven or inclined may give you more opportunity to intervene to stop it. I think the question of things like culpability, retribution versus a more pragmatic outcome for punishing crimes, for punishing wrongdoing, I think is still a good debate. And I'll give you an example. I think probably a majority opinion of among biologists might favor thinking about less retributive ideas. I actually think retribution is quite an interesting area. I like to joke that I'm really a fan of retribution. I am joking in this that I'm a fan of studying retribution. But I do think that our sense of wanting to punish when we see something wrong done reflects, I think, the best evidence. It's not settled, but I think that the evidence is interestingly strong, that we have a sort of an internal drive, and that reflects the fact that we have evolved to not like it when people do something wrong and to have a desire to impose some kind of cost, Now, our desire might get out of hand. We might impose too great a cost. We might go and attack someone and do things we ought not to. Right. But that desire, I think what we can learn from evolution is that that serves some useful purpose. And we may not want to encourage people just to go out and engage in vendettas or engage in private punishment. But that recognizing that punishment serves a social purpose and that sense of wanting retribution came to us through a long history in which it served a useful goal, I think is something we ought to take into account.
Right. Yeah, I could see how, as we evolved in social groups, having that urge to get the injustice addressed, even if it didn't happen to you, it just hurts you to see it happen, would be useful in policing the whole group. It might be a little misplaced now, or it might just need to take a back seat, but that's still a matter of debate, right? We still have retributive punishment. I mean, arguably that's what the death penalty is versus life in prison.
Yes, I think, and my sort of academic stance on retribution doesn't carry with it any particular prescription like, well, unrestrained retribution. Recognizing that the sense of retribution helps to shape our sense of what's a fair punishment, what's appropriate, of when something really has been settled and it's okay now. I think that's something we can take into account without saying that it somehow prescribes exactly how much is enough. We can simply look at it and realize that it can be a useful thing, and that one way to judge when a punishment is just is when a lot of people in society say, yeah, that's enough.
Right. One related phrase here that I enjoy hearing is altruistic punishment, because
yes,
there's something a little dissonant about that. But usually we think of altruism in a modern sense as giving money to charity, sacrificing resources to do something that is positive and makes everyone feel good. But altruistic punishment is altruistic because you're giving up resources, like you're spending money or spending time, energy, putting yourself at risk to enforce justice. And that's why it's still altruistic.
I agree. And I also like that phrase. I think it's a very appropriate phrase. And I like the sense, again, this is where a sense of a desire to punish can be a positive thing. If you imagine that I'm out here in Carrboro walking down the street and somebody's bothering me, somebody's picking on me, somebody's bullying me, and you come along and you see that, you say, you know, I don't like that. You know, they really shouldn't do that. And you come over and you help me. Now, maybe you help me by in some aggressive way, you threaten the person, or maybe you just kind of come over and you kind of, well, now there's two of us. But you invest some of your time. You kind of you were about your own business, and you take a little bit of your time, maybe put yourself at a little bit of risk to help me out. That you're acting altruistically toward me by threatening or actually punishing the person, imposing some kind of cost on the person who may be bothering me.
Yeah.
That's an altruistic act, and it's good for society.
That's an interesting example, because there's still some vigilanteism to it, or it's still outside the realm of the law. Unless it escalates a lot and you get mauled, then you could take that to the courts. But if it's just a small bullying, harassment, confrontation, then the only mechanism to counteract that, unless, I don't know, I guess there's a police officer standing right there, is just other people acting on their social instincts.
Yes, and I think we can think about those urges as ranging from the little day-to-day stuff in which it would never be a matter for the law. It's not even a criminal act. It's just someone being nice or not nice to another person, and a colleague is willing to intervene to encourage an outcome that more of us would think of as just. Well, that's a third-party intervention and third-party enforcement. It might take the form of punishment, but social punishment. You know, I don't like that very much. And that may go all the way up to large-scale and very serious punishment of criminal acts, imposing societal sanctions that are implemented by the state, by the police, by prosecutions, on people who either acts of violence, murders and bank robberies and so forth, or other kinds of actions, financial crimes, or just other kinds of wrongdoing. So I think that basic drive in us to sort of put in a little effort, invest something, incur some cost to see things put right, I think drives all of that. And one of the things I think is fascinating to study is how that plays out on those different scales.
Right. Well, one analogy between that scenario where you're being bullied and just the criminal justice in general is that when I'm helping you out, I have the option of being more violent toward that person or more empathetic and just trying to avoid harm to anyone at all, as much as I can. So I can just try to diffuse the situation, help us walk away without anyone getting hurt, or I can go up and have some bravura and feel, you know, so disgusted that I need to insult this person publicly and maybe push them over. And I think it's similar to sort of the death sentence versus life in prison with therapy comparison. I'm wondering, in the long term, if you think that we should move toward more of the street equivalent of diffusing the situation and walking away, or in criminal justice, it would just be being compassionate toward everyone and sort of trying to inflict as little harm as possible. Is that something worth striving for? Or that it sounds like, since you're a fan of retribution, I might not be able to get you to say that.
I'm not sure you can get me to say it now. And now I have said publicly I'm a fan of retribution. I'll have to remind you, I'm a fan of studying retribution. So I think you raise a really interesting question about whether, both as a practical matter and then, as you say, as a normative matter, as a practical matter, will a majority of people, will society in general be satisfied with outcomes in which there is, if you could imagine outcomes in which a crime has occurred, some bad action has occurred, and people are outraged, people are upset about it, whether society will be more stable and people will feel vindicated as members of society if the culprit, the person who has done the bad act, is simply contained or perhaps rehabilitated, and there's no sense that they suffered a loss. And I think that's an interesting practical question. How much is enough for people to feel okay about the process? Then, as a normative matter, I think you also raise the question: is, you know, which is the better outcome? And I think, you know, here I'm not speaking as a scientist, just as a person that, you know, I am inclined to the view that if we could have a good outcome and the everybody goes on with their lives and the former malfeasor is now a better person, that sounds like a more pleasant outcome. But I'm not sure how many of us would advocate that. I imagine we could come up with scenarios in which we would start to feel that that was not really an acceptable circumstance. But it's an interesting, very interesting to think about our sense of retribution. What does it take to satisfy it?
Yeah. Well, just for our listeners, we're speaking with Dr. Pate Skeen. He's a neurobiologist at Duke University and soon to be law graduate as well. And that's why we're talking about neuroscience and the law. So we've been talking about how eyewitnesses can sometimes be flawed, and that can be a source of wrongful convictions, which is just one of many applied areas to study how neuroscience can improve the criminal justice system. But then on the other hand, we've been talking about how people actually have good heuristics, biases, shortcuts that can help make snap decisions that are correct or that are good enough, or, you know, people have decent memories. And so it's more about looking at the cases where we do go wrong than tweaking, like judges who are hungry and don't grant parole as much. So we were just talking about retribution versus restoration, rehabilitation, whatever else you want to counterpose it with. And I think it's important that you do distinguish between a normative perspective, sort of prescribing what's right and wrong, and just the descriptive perspective. Because even when we're describing, we can look at the fact that people have the thirst for retribution and say, well, what do we do with that if we're not going to exact much punishment? It seems like we've come some way if you compare it to the Middle Ages, when punishment might involve like stretching someone's arms until they snapped off, or drowning people, all kinds of torture that wouldn't usually be acceptable and as part of, you know, getting rid of a wrongdoer, showing them what they deserve. So it seems like we can definitely tone down our bloodthirst quite a bit while still having retribution, just from looking at history.
I think you're right. I've begun trying to learn a little about legal history and legal history in other contexts, and I think you're right that traditionally some sort of physical punishment has been at least what criminal law has thought of, and going back from whether we're talking about the Western tradition in Europe or Chinese traditions, other traditions in other countries, and I do think that the fact that we have a sense of wanting retribution, that is, we want to see someone who has violated our norms suffer some kind of loss. It raises an interesting question biologically, and I don't think we know the answer, but I think you touch on something that sort of, as a day-to-day matter suggests that the form that takes may not be so fixed. We might first think about violent punishment or imprisonment or something else may come to mind first. I don't think we know anything about from the point of view of neuroscience, I don't think we know what it takes to satisfy that sense that appropriate punishment has occurred. And I think it's an interesting area for research for just the reason you said. If we think about the sense of retribution as serving a purpose not for the defendant, the criminal, the person who's being punished, but serving a purpose for people in society who see that punishment happen. We often talk about deterrence, and I think that's true, but an awful lot of people in society weren't planning to commit the crime anyway. So it's not just deterrence. There's also the sense of what does it take for people to feel that they live in a just society, that they can buy into behaving as good citizens and so forth. So I think if we begin to understand what does it take to have the system seen as doing justice, to have people feel that they live in a just society, we can ask those questions. Do you really have to execute somebody? Do you really have to put them in prison for 20 years? Do you really have to engage in some other harsh punishment? Or do we have other ways to punish that satisfy that sense, that give us a stable society, that make people feel secure in society by serving that need for retribution? And perhaps we can do that in ways that as you say, are less harsh and less costly to all of us.
Right. Yeah, I'm fascinated by the idea that you can frame the same crime or the same person in many different ways. And a lot of getting people to a point of satisfaction is about how you frame the whole situation. I'm imagining, for example, if we take like the most horrible criminal you can imagine, some kind of sexual offender, murderer, and you ask their parents what punishment they deserve, you're going to get one extreme of the spectrum. You're going to get probably on the high end of compassion for this person. Or maybe if you ask some kind of nun or monk who just tries to reflect compassionately on all human beings, you're going to get one extreme point of what humans are capable of. And then you could get an opposite point of the family of the victims. And you're going to get the least amount of compassion, very different framing on the same facts. And I think within that spectrum, there's a lot of wiggle room depending on what neuroscience tells us about how we can affect people's decisions or how we can involve communities in sentencing. Who knows? But I think there's a lot of spectrum to make changes. That's my intuition anyway.
I think you're right, and you touch on another area in which I think neuroscience can provide some useful information. We will need to do more research on it. But the relation, both the framing, how we explain the situation or from what viewpoint we explain the situation to somebody, but also the consequences of that in the reality. If you focus on a person who has carried out an act, a defendant, an accused, then you are thinking in terms of that person, their history, their background, and that may be a more sympathetic or a less sympathetic viewpoint. But you're thinking about whether the decision maker, the person making the judgment, how they identify with that person and how they respond to that the relationship with that person, whether that's a positive or a negative viewpoint. If you're talking about the victim's family, they're thinking from the point of view of the victim. If you're talking about society, they might take either viewpoint or they might think about their own lives and their own community. One of the interesting things, I think a fascinating area, is how we form those, what that's doing to our brains when we, when I think about you and we've been having this conversation for a while, so now we have a relationship. So I think about you differently than an hour ago when I had first met you. If I think about the victim, what's that doing to my brain and how does that affect my decisions? I find interesting from a basic science point of view, but from a practical point of view also lets us think about as we understand those, which of those do we think are legitimate? Which of those do we want to accommodate because they're appropriate? And which of those do we think of as biases in the sense that we do not want them taken into account? We want a neutral person making those decisions.
Right. I'm reminded when you talk about what's happening in the brain about the idea of trust and oxytocin, and there's some preliminary work on spraying and oxytocin up people's noses and seeing how they behave in economic games with each other.
That's exactly right, yes. Oxytocin and a related peptide, vasopressin, very, very much involved in our social interactions, in helping us to form social bonds, the very active area of research and one that I think really deserves more investigation to understand the complexities of it. That is, does it in itself drive a sense of trust, or does it facilitate a sense of whatever interactions have occurred, that is trusting or non-trusting? How dominant is it? Is it as simple as we get a burst of oxytocin and that's our bond, or it plays a role in some more complex system? And for just the reasons that you were raising, that as we understand how our brains are being affected as we form a bond with other people, whether that's a romantic bond, whether it's a family or close friendship, one-on-one bond, important kinds of bonds that have important social implications. If you're in a military unit and those bonds are critically important for the ability to literally sacrifice your life for your brothers or your sisters, if you're in a working group or if you're in a community or a neighborhood, what contributes to those bonds and how does that affect the way we make decisions? I think it's fascinating and I think we know way too little about it.
Right, yeah, lots of room to, and I guess one eventual realm of application would be to try to encourage certain types of bonds that either, I mean, I guess the best thing would be to just prevent crimes in the first place by creating certain types of bonds. But then also, I guess, at some point, too, the bonding is not always good, I wonder. I wonder if you have an opinion on that.
Absolutely, yes. I was going to say, I am one of people who, one of the many people who sort of thinks of bonding as a good thing. It's great to have, to feel close to people, to have friends, to have colleagues. But we have to remember that by forming bonds with some people, you exclude other people. So people talk about that as tribalism. The jargon is in-group and out-group relationships. So if whatever your group is, whether that's family or friends or whatever group, your workplace group, your military unit, those bonds of trust, of cooperation, of being willing to sacrifice for those excludes other people whom you don't think of as human in that way. You have not made a human connection with those. And that can have negative consequences. It can have tribalism in the sense of one group disliking members of another group, having conflict. Sort of classic, you know, conflict terms is, I've bonded with my brothers in my military unit, and I am willing to go and kill the people in another, in those, that out group. But it also takes forms in our society, whether that's a racial group or an ethnic group or a socioeconomic group or those nasty guys in that other business that I compete with. That sense of those people as being less human than my group can create the exact opposite of what we were talking about. I am now rather than my in-group being people I'm willing to sacrifice for, behave altruistically toward, cooperate with, I'm willing to treat other the people that I now think of as not like that very badly, and not give to them the kinds of consideration that I would give, that I would even sit here and argue to you is the way we ought to treat people, but not those people. And I think right, that's the sort of thing we really would like to understand at the basic science level, as well as at a social level and in terms of applications of the law.
And yeah, that's just one of many balancing acts in applying neuroscience and law. You want people to have some connection to each other without forming outgroups and forming tribes and getting to a point where they're discriminating against certain groups unfairly. So then it's hard to even imagine what the utopia would be. I guess one idea is this like global country where everyone's just proud of being on Earth, but that hasn't quite panned out yet.
That's true, and I think perhaps on a more modest level of goal, of ambition, is understanding how these processes work so that we can be, as we were talking about with the Israeli judges or with the other people, prosecutors making decisions, as we understand the pluses and minuses and just understand the mechanism, I think we can talk about how we want to take those into account. So I think what science can bring us is, whether we're looking at oxytocin or looking at other mechanisms of social bonding, that as we understand those processes, we can then step back and, using the tools of traditional legal analysis or traditional philosophy or other normative questions, we can ask, how do we want to take into account those natural tendencies? And as you say, if we're not going to get rid of them, we're not simply going to create a new kind of biology for ourselves, then we can look at what our actual biology is and think, now, how do we set up, for example, legal procedures in a way that encourages appropriate sort of humanizing of people whose judgments, on whom we need to make judgments, and discourages inappropriate dehumanizing.
Yeah. Well, I want to make a sort of a public service angle here toward the end, because I think that while neuroscience has this power to add extra layers of understanding to ourselves, to the legal system, it also has a certain hype or sexiness to it that could be dangerous. And I know in the last decade, we've seen companies like No Lie MRI come out saying, we have like very highly accurate fMRI techniques to see if someone's lying, to like prove that they're innocent or guilty. And they're, especially in sentencing after someone's already been convicted, especially in death penalty cases, prosecutors or defendants will introduce brain scan sort of evidence to try to say this is a person who has overactive amygdala and they're the sort of rabid dog who's going to commit crimes without lots of intention or conscious thought involved. And this seems to have worked in jurors in the past to think, oh, okay, well, there's this colorful picture of a brain. Therefore, I guess we're not going to have such a harsh sentence for this person because they're almost an automaton slave to their brain. So it's between lie detection and using flashy pictures of brains in the courtroom, they're just two examples where the impression might not actually match the power of the tools that are being used. What do you think about that?
No, and a really important point, too. I think that and a number of people are looking at this. Nita Farahani at Vanderbilt has been looking closely at the sort of constitutional implications of the kinds of current brain imaging and brain analysis evidence, and also what one might reasonably anticipate for the future. And I think it really is a serious point, because the risk of introducing flashy pictures, sort of overweighting of evidence, I think is a real risk. I've been actually quite impressed in my venture into the law with how effectively lawyers generally have been generally able to recognize, get up to speed on a technology, and pretty quickly find the limitations of it, which I think is a very healthy thing. As I said, one of the discoveries I made, encounters as I began to learn something about law, was we're not the first people to think about these problems, and this is not the first time around the block for lawyers encountering the situation in which there's new information, new technology, and people seeking, on the one hand, to introduce information. And while one can say many things about our adversarial system of laws, one of its great strengths is every time somebody seeks to introduce something into the courtroom, there's somebody on the other side looking very carefully at what its limitations are. And I think that's a really good example of where that's a very healthy thing.
Right. Yeah, the adversarial system. Well, I'm reminded of this idea from business and marketing, that of the cycle of hype. I think we're actually past what's called the peak of inflated expectations. When something is first introduced, a new technology or a new idea first reaches wide-scale awareness, people aren't quite prepared. So, you know, the adversarial system is still calibrating. Like, how important are these flashy images? I think we're falling into what's called the trough of disillusionment, and then we'll eventually come to like what they call the peak, the plateau of enlightenment, where we're using the tools when they're appropriate, but we're not overhyping them or getting wowed by them too much. That's the hope.
I think that's a justified hope. I agree with you. I think that we're rapidly approaching a place in which, you know, some very smart lawyers can look at the realities of whatever's sought to be introduced into a courtroom, and judges are working hard to understand this so that they can make good rulings. And I will make the quick pitch that I think, you know, for the most part, I think it would not. I'd be in the mainstream of neuroscience to say neuroscience is pretty effective at looking at groups of people. When you start talking about one individual person and what you can say about them, that's not really what those tools are generally designed to do. So I think it'll be a while before we're wanting to use neuroscience extensively for those kinds of analysis.
Right. Yeah. The distinction between knowing something about groups and individuals is important. And there are also just so many different scales of studying. It sounds to me like neuroscience is naturally inhabiting this very fine-grained scale. I mean, you came from studying axons,
yes.
and that, how much more fine-grained does it get than that? But then you can still try to bring neuroscience concepts to groups of people. So just as to wrap up, do you have the sense of what the underlying thread is between the basic science you've done in the past and the law and some of the questions we've been talking about this hour? Is there one source of insight that binds those all together?
Well, for me personally, I have been fascinated since high school many years ago with the notion of how a set of genes can be read out to put together a brain that can then engage with the world and in response to all kinds of experiences change its processing. And I have found that absolutely fascinating for my entire juvenile and adult life. And I still find it fascinating. And it's simply taken the form of asking questions about how axons grow and make their connections and then how they might repair them if they're broken or change them in response to experience, to now shifting to questions about how those same genes have evolved over time to put together circuits that set us up to engage with the world in this very social way.
Right.
So to me, that's the connection.
Yeah, and that's quite a grand vision of all these steps involved in producing all our loves and sorrows and mistakes. And I guess I want to play devil's advocate and say, well, you neuroscientists are just turning us into organic robots, and where's the spark of life in there, right? What would you say to someone like that?
I certainly not turning us into robots in the sense that I think my vision of the link from genes to putting together a brain to that brain engaging with the world has that important component of that brain engaging with the world. It's like almost any mechanism you might imagine. Once you have the brain in place, you have something set up with its sets of rules of how it behaves. That doesn't tell you what it's going to do. That
right.
just sets a set of a certain template in place that now is ready to engage with the world and with other people. And that's a very dynamic process.
Right. Yeah, I look forward to hearing more about your work as you finish your degree and start digging into some of these questions and all the complexity of the legal system in our brains.
Well, thank you very much for having me over. It was a great pleasure.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming on. For our listeners, again, this has been a discussion of neuroscience and the law. We've been speaking with Dr. Pate Skeen. He's a longtime neurobiologist at Duke University. He had a career studying axon growth, very basic science in the brain, and is now looking more at genes and neuromechanisms underlying cooperation and punishment. And you've been listening to Psych Talk this hour. You can find Psych Talk online at psychtalkradio.com. That's PSYCH, talkradio.com. There you'll find podcasts, blog posts, and ways to connect with us on social media, including Twitter, Facebook, and Google+. Thanks.